From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and here we are 3 days after the news broke that the FBI is looking into more emails that may be connected to the investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private server. How much has this news affected the state of the presidential race? Joining us now is NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hi there.
And we don't have very much polling that's come after the news on Friday, but there is a new Politico morning consult poll out today that was done over the weekend, and it doesn't show much damage for Hillary Clinton even after the news broke on Friday. What are your thoughts about how this news might or is or isn't affecting the race?
Well, you know, it's never a good idea to focus on one poll in the immediate after hours of any kind of an event, unless you were a pollster looking to measure the depth or the height of some kind of fallout. The fact is, when big news events happen, you got to wait a week, week and a half, until you really know what impact it's had more broadly in a race. Unfortunately for us, a week, week and a half
right.
is election day. So we'll have that very good poll on Tuesday.
But we are seeing a tightening generally. It could have started before and probably did start before the news came out on Friday. But it does look like many of the polls are starting to tighten.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if I can say many, but I would say that there's something, and it's also hard to peg to what exactly, because, you know, there's been something of a natural tightening. There usually is a something of a natural tightening as you head toward election day, because voters who might have been thinking about another candidate come home, or undecideds finally start to make up their minds. And they on those undecided voters, if you're talking about people who voted Republican heavily in past elections or Democratic in past elections, they usually go the way that they're used to voting. So that's some of what you're seeing, as well as the fact that, let's be honest, there were some of the Obamacare news that came out last week. You
right.
had this email stuff. You know, when there's bad news in the you know, front pages of the papers and on the air, then that's a slight direction of where things are going. But frankly here, people are pretty baked in with how they think about these two candidates.
And what about the down ballot candidates, people running for Senate and the House? Does this news affect them?
Well, it certainly could. I mean, if the what happens after this reminds people of Hillary Clinton's thought untrustworthiness or whatever it is for independents or persuadable voters, and the effect winds up being that Hillary Clinton's red map expansion is suddenly curtailed, and Donald Trump is able to pull off winning Georgia or Arizona, Utah, and all of that expansion suddenly stops, then you could see potentially some of those Republicans in some of the swing states be able to try to separate themselves still from Trump. That's not to say that's necessarily going to happen, but you are seeing right now Democrats favored still to win back the Senate, be it narrowly. And either way, you're going to have a very narrow majority for either party come next Congress.
We also hear a lot, and we have heard a lot, about how little ground game Donald Trump has.
Right.
Is that still true, and does that matter in this last week? If Hillary Clinton is hurt in the polls, does it matter a little less because she's got a much stronger ground game?
Well, there's a distinction between the Trump campaign and the Republican National Committee. The Trump campaign has almost no ground game. The Republican National Committee is almost 100% supplanting what would be typical work that that a Republican campaign would be doing. Yes, the RNC has lots of staffers. They're focusing very heavily in swing states like Florida, where Donald Trump has to win in order to have any path to the presidency. But the Clinton campaign has been doing this a while. They have good analytics teams. They know the voters that not only she needs to turn out, but voters that President Obama turned out in 2012 and 2008. And they just need to target and find the metrics to get those voters out to the polls, something that's been tried and tested twice for this president.
Looks like both of the candidates are going to be spending some time in Florida between now and Election Day, but also Hillary Clinton heading out to Arizona. Trump's going to be in Wisconsin tomorrow. Are these surprising places, do you think, for these candidates to be spending their final days?
Well, a couple of things. You know, Hillary Clinton wants to expand the map. She wants to be able to show a very broad win if she's able to win. So pulling off a place like Arizona or a place like Georgia or a place even like North Carolina, where few had probably thought a cycle or two ago could be possible. But in Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, New Mexico, where you see Mike Pence, these are all places that Donald Trump you know, if he could have a shot to win, he's got to pick off some kind of Democratic-leaning state. Most likely path for him would have been a place like New Hampshire or Pennsylvania, but the numbers haven't really moved in his direction, so he's trying something else. And at this point, it's a little bit of a Hail Mary.
And, of course, we've already had more than 22 million people cast ballots in early voting in my neighborhood. There was a two-hour wait on Saturday. NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro, thanks as always.
Oh, thank you. You're welcome.
Well, in Newark today, closing arguments resume in the so-called Bridgegate trial of two former allies of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Both Bridget Ann Kelly, Christie's former deputy chief of staff, and Bill Baroni, a top Christie appointee at the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, are charged with 9 counts of conspiracy, fraud, and other charges related to the September 2013 lane closures on the George Washington Bridge. You remember the closings caused a 4-day traffic jam. Prosecutors say it was political payback after the mayor of Fort Lee, New Jersey, declined to endorse Christie. The governor is not on trial, but his fate may be tied to it. During the proceedings, 3 people, including Kelly and Baroni, contradicted Christie's earlier claims that he did not know about the closures. Joe Hernandez is covering the trial for Here and Now contributor WHYY. And Joe, we have the second day of closing arguments today. What did we hear from the prosecution on Friday?
Well, federal prosecutors reiterated what they've been saying this entire time, which is that Kelly and Baroni were a key part of this conspiracy to cause traffic jams as political payback. The prosecutor on Friday began his closing argument with that now infamous email from Kelly stating, quote, "It's time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee." He said Kelly and Baroni were so intent on helping Christie's political career that they took it upon themselves to punish this mayor who was refusing to endorse the boss.
Yeah, they say they did it by setting up a fake traffic study, which led to this huge jam. So what's the defense saying?
Well, the defense, both defendants are saying they thought this was a legitimate traffic study. And both defense teams are really pushing back on the government's key witness, who's this guy named David Wildstein. So Wildstein was Baroni's number 2 at the agency at the Port Authority. But witnesses said Wildstein's boss was actually Christie. The two were high school classmates. And it's said that Christie got Wildstein that job at the Port Authority. Now, Wildstein has pleaded guilty to his role, and he's testified for the government, but both defense teams are saying, listen, this guy Wildstein is a liar. He was a shady political operative beforehand, and he brought that kind of cutthroat political mentality to the Port Authority. So the defense attorneys are saying, if you can't trust David Wildstein, then you can't convict these two defendants.
So the two defendants are saying, hey, he's tying us to this. We're trying to say that Christie knew about it.
Right. Yeah. Well, Bridget Ann Kelly, who was an aide to Christie, she was a deputy chief of staff, said that she actually briefed the governor on this traffic study when she says everyone still kind of thought it was a traffic study and that Christie approved it. And that time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee email was actually just kind of a joking offhand remark, she says, to Wildstein saying the governor's heard about the traffic study. He's okay with it. Go ahead.
Yeah. And didn't she also say that Christie threw a water bottle at her?
She did. This was at an event after a fire on the boardwalk, which was around the time of these traffic jams. And she had set up an event for him. It was a round table. And she testified that Christie, when she was about to brief him on the event, she said, why don't you sit down and throw it to the agency heads who are here and they can kind of describe to the victims of this fire what services are available. And he said, do I look like an effing game show host? And she said he threw a bottle at her.
Okay. So this has been coming out over these 7 weeks of deliberation or the process of the trial. But now we go to jury deliberations. What's the possible outcome for Kelly and Baroni?
Well, they're both facing a number of federal charges. They include wire fraud, conspiracy, civil rights violations, and misapplying the resources of the Port Authority. The most serious of those crimes carries a maximum penalty of 20 years in prison. So if convicted, Baroni and Kelly could face some jail time.
Yeah. And what about Christie? Not on trial, we rush to say again. But what are the people in New Jersey saying about these stories that they're hearing?
Well, he's not on trial, like you said. He wasn't called as a witness, but not a day went by where his name wasn't mentioned. His most recent approval rating was at 21% in New Jersey. So 1 in 5 people in the state approve of the job he's doing, which is a record low for him. And, you know, Bridgegate certainly played a role in that, but there are plenty of reasons for it, including his support for gas tax here. So he's not very popular right now in the state.
Well, two things. First of all, will he face charges on this someday? Is there that possibility? But secondly, he's leading Donald Trump's transition team. There's a chance, I'm sure he's hoping for, that he'd have a role in a Trump administration. How does this affect that?
Right. Well, as you know, Christie was not chosen to be Trump's vice presidential candidate. It seems like during the course of the Bridgegate trial, Christie has taken a bit of a backseat in the Trump campaign. But to your first question, whether he would stand trial in the future, it's not likely, but it's not impossible. U.S. Attorney Paul Fishman, who brought these charges, said last year that he's done indicting people for Bridgegate given the evidence that he had. But he's been sitting in at the trial quite often, so you never know.
Right. Joe Hernandez, of Here and Now contributor WHYY, as the so-called Bridgegate trial continues in New Jersey. It's going to go to the jury soon. Joe, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Premiums are going up by an average of nearly 25% next year for the 38 states that use the Affordable Care Act's Health Insurance Exchange. It will be even higher for people in Arizona. Until recently, that state was credited with having one of the most robust markets. But soon, the marketplace there will look a lot different, with fewer options and higher premiums. Will Stone of Here and Now contributor KJZZ reports.
Sarah Dixon's no stranger to healthcare.gov.
Every year I've switched a plan, yeah. Because they weren't available.
Dixon's a graphic designer who's self-employed, living in Scottsdale. And this year's no different. Her policy is being canceled. And she's not enthused about the prospect of buying new insurance for the fourth time.
I've considered not having health care because it's too frustrating. But because I have a daughter, it's too irresponsible to not have coverage. And I'm usually the one that gets injured anyway, so I need it.
Instead, she'll try to get on her husband's group policy, even though it's costed much more in the past. This year, 120,000-plus people in Maricopa County, home to more than half of the state's population, and the Phoenix metro area, will lose their policies. That's because so many insurers have fled the marketplace. This time last year, there were 8 in the state. Now only 2 remain. And this turbulence has trickled down to consumers like Dixon.
There's no coordinated care, and you have to start over with a new doctor every time. And things are going to get missed, and they do get missed.
For example, her 4-year-old daughter has bounced around to different doctors, causing her to be late for her annual wellness exam.
These people played by the rules. They went to the doctors in the network, as they were told, and now the network's going away.
That's Bill Gould, who runs Black Gould & Associates, a Phoenix-based insurance agency. 4,000 of their individual policies are being canceled this year.
And then they find out that the rates are higher, the deductibles are higher, the coverage is less, and they don't have their doctor.
Premiums are climbing faster than before across the country, but Arizona's situation is especially pronounced. A 27-year-old could see a 116% hike for a benchmark plan, which is what the subsidies are based upon.
This time next year, there will be less people covered by insurance than there is right now.
Gould says young people may just take the penalty for not having insurance. For a single person, that's nearly $700 or a fraction of your income. But proponents of the Affordable Care Act say those numbers don't tell the full story.
We don't believe that this is the failure of the exchange right now.
Marcus Johnson is with Vitalist Health Foundation, part of a coalition working in Arizona to enroll people.
Even if a health insurance plan is costing a little bit more, the subsidies, the payments that the general consumer will receive back from the government, are also going to increase.
Indeed, most consumers here qualify for the tax credit and will pay a monthly premium of $100 or less, according to federal numbers. And Johnson says while there's no competition among insurers on the exchange,
there are still health insurance plans, multiple plans, within each health insurance company in every single county.
The majority of counties have 5 plans available. The caveat, these are HMO policies with limited benefits out of network. Jerry Anderson runs Anderson Insurance Services and says, true, many people will not pay the full costs. But for those who do, it will be tough.
And we're talking middle class. You're just above the line where to qualify for subsidies, so you're going to have to pay the full premium, and they simply can't afford it.
For example, a 40-year-old couple with two children would pay about $1,400 per month. The fluctuations in the marketplace have changed the way Anderson does business.
It used to be that most people would pick a plan and they would stay with it for years. And now, because of the dramatic changes every single year, everybody has to think on a 12-month basis.
But Kevin Griffiths with the Department of Health and Human Services says Arizona has been an outlier. Before this year, it actually had the lowest rates in all of the healthcare.gov system.
Now, I think what we're seeing is that the rates overall are catching up with the actual costs.
He expects more people who are currently not on the exchange will qualify for subsidies and come on board. And don't forget the big picture, he says. There are 410,000 more people insured in the state than before the Affordable Care Act. Even consumers like Sarah Dixon, who are frustrated, acknowledge that's a good thing.
But I had a fairly positive outlook on it, and it actually worked for me in the beginning.
The question, can it start working again for people like her, this open enrollment period? For Here and Now, I'm Will Stone in Phoenix.
So that's what's happening in Arizona. In some states, premiums will go up less than in Arizona, and in some, they're going down. We're joined now by Jason Schaffrin, senior research economist at Precision Health Economics. And Jason, most states will see an increase, but why is there such a big range in the rate of that increase?
Well, I think you need to think about this like any market. There's a supply and a demand side. And on the supply side, like you see in Arizona, you see a number of the health insurers are exiting the market, and that will vary across states. You see Aetna and United Healthcare have left completely. At the same time, I think it's important to look at not just the changes, but what is the actual premium. So Arizona has seen, obviously, a big increase in their premiums. They've had went from about eight insurers to, you know, one or two. But also, if you look at Vermont or Wyoming, they've seen a small increases in health insurance premiums, less than 10%, but they were already high to begin with. Vermont only had about two plans, and that's what they'll have next year, and Wyoming about one. So the changes, I think, are very important to look at, but also, you know, the level of cost. And then on the demand side, you definitely want to look at the risk pool. If you have all sick people, their premiums will have to be higher. If you have more healthy people, they'll be lower. So that will vary across state as well, and insurers need to predict what is the health risk pool going to look like in 2017.
So on the supply side, when there are fewer insurers in the market, is there a good reason that the premium goes up, or is it just because they can, because they don't have any competition?
I think a lot of it'll depend on market to market. Part of it is that they can. If you have, you know, fewer health plans, you're going to have higher prices because of the lack of competition.
And there's nothing that governments can do to stop the premiums from going up just by statute?
Well, of course, you can set the prices. I think that that's kind of a risk. So how well can the government set the prices? If you look at, you know, how well are insurers setting the prices, you see that early on in 2014, if you look at how much are they paying out in medical claims, the medical claims were much higher initially. That could have been a strategic reason. They wanted to get a higher market share initially. It could have been this is a brand new market, so they didn't really know who's going to sign up. So I think to say the government is going to set more prices, sure, they can lower the prices, but that also risks that more plans will exit. So that's a kind of a key trade-off.
So what about the states where the premiums are actually going down? Indiana, Massachusetts. Is that more to do with the amount of players in the market, or is that more to do with the people who are trying to buy plans?
I think that's a case-by-case basis. There's a number of different things on the lower end. A lot of plans are looking at more narrow networks where before you may have had, you know, a bunch of choices in terms of physicians, hospitals. If you say, okay, well, you can only go to these few hospitals or these few physician groups, you know, you can target the cheaper ones, and that can lower your costs. So some states where the plans are more aggressively doing narrow networks, that's one possibility why the premiums can go down. I mean, another thing could be that, you know, previously they were better at pricing, and so, you know, they haven't gone down as much. There's a number of different explanations.
So if you look at what's happened in the last few years, the average increase in premiums was just 2% in 2015. It was 7.5% this year, and now we're talking about 25% for next year. What's going on there? Why is it getting so much worse?
Well, I think there are some one-time factors to consider. One of them is the reinsurance. So previously, what the federal government did was they said, for the health plans, if you have a really sick patient, you have a lot of cost, we'll pay a portion of that because this is a new market. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty. So we're going to provide this reinsurance for your sickest patients and help provide some money. That's gone down over time. And 2017 is the first year where that money has gone away completely. So, you know, those costs someone has to pay for before the federal government was paying for it, you know, taxpayers. Now that's going out of the health plan. So that's kind of a one-time cost. Also, you can see a lot of provider consolidation. So hospitals are buying physician groups, post-acute care facilities, nursing homes, they're combining. Part of that is to have better health care in terms of, you know, there's accountable care organizations, measure quality, et cetera. So there's some benefits to this integration. At the same time, by having these bigger groups, they can negotiate higher prices with the insurers. And if there's fewer competition on the provider side, those will increase prices. So that's kind of a general trend as well. So if a lot of the healthier people stop pulling out because of the higher premiums, your risk pool will get sicker and sicker and the premiums will go up. If it's just a one-time thing, and that won't be as big a deal.
I've seen a healthcare CEO quoted as saying that the next administration is going to have less than a year to fix Obamacare, or we're going to see more insurers pull out of various states and the premiums are going to go up even more. Do you agree with that?
I think this is the key question. Is this a one-time thing where we have some of this reinsurance costs, we have some of this provider consolidation, or is this a longer-term issue? If patients start pulling out and you're left with just sick people, it's going to be very problematic. So I agree that there needs to be competition for the health plan side. The patients need to be incentivized to participate. I know some of the political candidates have proposed, you know, additional penalties for not buying insurance and additional subsidies for, you know, if you do buy it. So some of those things could help solidify the market. We'll have to see what happens.
That's Jason Schaffrin, a senior research economist at Precision Health Economics. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
And another big merger announced today. General Electric and Baker Hughes are moving to combine their oil and gas businesses. Oh, also CenturyLink says it will buy Level 3 Communications and create a bigger telecommunications internet service provider. What's with all the mergers? The Associated Press says U.S. firms are cutting merger deals at a record pace, $251 billion in worth this month alone, according to the tracker DealLogic. That's passing last year's July record of $240 billion. Jill Schlesinger is a business analyst with CBS News. She hosts Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And let's first take a look at these two mergers, then we'll go wider. But the oil and gas market, they've been battered lately. So what do you make of the GE Baker Hughes merger? What does it do for the two companies?
Well, I think for GE, it's a great bet on the eventual recovery on the oil and gas industry. You know, you're basically able to buy Baker Hughes at, I wouldn't say $30 billion is a bargain basement price, but obviously since the sector has been depleted, then you at least have a shot at buying the lows and of this cycle. Mm-hmm. And it's really an interesting way to play the recovery without, say, putting a huge bet on the oil and gas futures markets.
Right. Well, Baker Hughes had been trying to merge with Halliburton, and that deal fell apart because of a regulatory fight with the federal government. So is there reason to believe the merger with GE will work?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a slightly different deal here because GE is really putting itself in a place to provide equipment and services to oils and rigs, which they have. So this big industrial company, also kind of interesting in the GE story, which is, you know, that they really went and shed a lot of their non-core businesses like GE Capital. And really, this is a big indication that they're shifting to their industrial base. So, I mean, look, I don't know. Everything has under regulatory scrutiny. This one, to me, seems a little bit more reasonable in terms of passing muster with the regulators.
And then you've got this Level 3 CenturyLink deal. A lot of parts of the country haven't even heard of these companies, but they say they want to have the biggest telecommunications internet service provider.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of wild because, as you said, it's like sort of two under-the-radar companies, and yet it's about a $25 billion marriage. So, okay, so Level 3 is one of those companies that's sort of not the actual phone company, but the pipes of the telecommunications firms. Mm-hmm. And CenturyLink runs these, you know, very sort of outside of the mainstream rural local phone services. And so I think that this is kind of interesting. They're going to look to see if the combination makes them more able to really manage the much more competitive landscape as these big companies come online.
But why is all of this happening, all these mergers, right before an election?
Yeah, I think that there's two big reasons. One is these mergers are occurring, a lot of them with debt, and really the ability to borrow money is really easy right now, and rates are really low. And so now you're doing these fantastic deals at what essentially is kind of like rock-bottom interest rates. So that's one thing. The other thing is this is a very quick way to boost your sales and profit and grow your market share at a time where the economy's not growing by that much. So what are you telling the market? We may not be able to grow organically, but we found a company that will make these numbers look better. Just a reminder, these deals are not usually very friendly to the consumer at the end of the day, but they are usually quite friendly to the shareholders.
Well, and the federal government under the Obama administration has opposed some of these high-profile deals. Interesting to see what happens under whatever the potential administrations are. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Thanks as always.
Take care.
There's a new law in Austin, Texas, that requires all new residential buildings to have smart thermostats, as in Nest or Ecobee. The power company there, Austin Energy, is also offering rebates to people with smart thermostats who enroll in a program that allows Austin Energy to remotely access the thermostats to adjust the temperature when energy demand is highest. Joining us now is Deborah Kimberly, the Vice President of Customer Energy Solutions at Austin Energy. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well. And tell us how these smart thermostats work or how they're different from good old traditional thermostats that a lot of people still have.
Well, some people have thermostats that don't communicate at all. Some people have programmable thermostats, which was required under our previous energy code that's part of our building codes. And as many of your listeners know, two-way communicating thermostats made their debut a few years back, and they allow a customer, a resident, to communicate remotely from their smartphone with their thermostat, so you can adjust the settings up and down. Austin Energy was one of the first utilities in the country to launch we call it our Bring Your Own Thermostat program, back in 2013, that provided customers with a rebate for allowing us to adjust the degree settings on their thermostats during our hottest summer months, and they run from June to September.
But even if you don't adjust the thermostat for the customers, are these smart thermostats that much more efficient than, I guess you would say, a dumb thermostat?
Oh, much more efficient. We were one of the first to have a thermostat communicating one way. And at its peak, we had 90,000 one-way communicating thermostats. But the problem with that, Jeremy, was they required cycling an air conditioning unit on and off. And these thermostats require only a small adjustment in temperature settings, and it allows the customer to save energy. It allows the utility to avoid having to purchase energy, especially during periods when prices can spike really, really high. So I don't know about you, Jeremy, but we have thermostat wars in the Kimberly household. My husband used to adjust the thermostat down to a chilly 68 degrees when he was getting ready for work in the morning. And I'd come home at night, and there were practically icicles inside the home in the middle of the summer. And then, bam, you get your utility bill, and you see that you're going to be paying for electricity that you really didn't even use. So this way, I have the ability to remotely, when I'm at work, adjust that thermostat setting right back up. We save money. And frankly, all of our customers save as a result of that.
And you talk about the air conditioning cycling on and off. Is that a big energy user just to turn it on and turn it back off again?
It is. And frankly, air conditioning and lighting are the two biggest users of energy. So it's been a very effective program. And I know this is probably a little technical, but in the peak months of our summer, The market is capped at a price of $9,000 a megawatt hour. So imagine driving up to a gas station and finding out that the price of gas is not $2 a gallon, but it's going to be, say, $2,000 a gallon. So it's good for us. It's good for the environment. It saves our customers money.
So how does Austin go from where most places in this country are, which is if you want to go out and buy a smart thermostat, go for it, or mm-hmm. you can keep your old thermostat, to every new residential building must have this smart thermostat?
So it wasn't much of a step, to be honest with you, Jeremy, because already we had a building code that was 3 years old that required that any new residential building have a programmable thermostat. And we had very little, in fact, to no pushback from the builder community. Why? Because the builders were already building new homes that had what consumers want.
Do you think that other cities are also going to want to do the power saving program where the power company can actually adjust people's thermostats to save energy during peak times? Or is that a kind of keep Austin weird thing?
Oh, you know about Austin keeping us weird. No, other cities are doing that same sort of thing. A number of cities already had programs similar to our initial program where they can cycle air conditioning systems on and off. And this is a much easier thing to do through cloud-enabled services. So other cities did follow our lead, and it has a far greater impact on customer satisfaction.
That's Deborah Kimberly, the Vice President of Customer Energy Solutions at Austin Energy. It's a city that is requiring new residential buildings to use smart thermostats and also offering people the option of letting the power company turn the thermostat up or down during peak times. Deborah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, in Georgia, there's a county about 30 miles northeast of Atlanta where, for the first time, minorities make up a majority of the population. But the Gwinnett County Commission is all white and always has been. But perhaps not for long, thanks to an African-American candidate who's hoping to make history. Sam White of Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting reports.
The weekday rush hour winds down as Democrat Jim Sheely schmoozes voters on a restaurant patio in Norcross, Georgia. He's here to tell them why he should be the next Gwinnett County Commission chair.
You know, I think that anybody in public office should always think towards the next generation.
Sheely's a one-issue candidate. He wants to develop a light rail system to help reduce Gwinnett's bad traffic. Some roads in the county handle more than 250,000 vehicles on an average day. But there's something else on his mind, the all-white county commission.
I mean, something's wrong with that picture. In a county that's 53 to 56% minority.
Actually, the latest census says 58% of the county's population is non-white. Sheely believes the lack of representation means minority concerns don't get heard.
In a way, I don't think black and white. I think right. You know, so if I see something wrong, then I want to try to change it.
Bottom line is, are the community's interests being spoken to? Right now, the answer is no.
Jerry Gonzalez is executive director of the Georgia Association of Latino Elected Officials. His group and others are suing the Gwinnett County Commission for voting rights violations. They say the county's electoral districts were drawn to disenfranchise minority voters, and they want new districts they say will give those voters more of a voice.
It doesn't matter if we register a bunch of people to vote if their power to be able to exercise that vote is diluted.
I think that we're trying very hard to be a welcoming place and to make it good for everybody that's here.
Republican Charlotte Nash is a defendant in the lawsuit. She's also Jim Sheely's opponent for that at-large seat on the county commission. We spoke at a fall festival in Duluth. Think crowds, crafts, and carnival food. Nash declined to comment on the suit, but said the commission is doing its best to accommodate the county's changing population.
A community is just like a living organism. If it's not growing and evolving, then eventually it's going to be destroyed. It can't survive unless it evolves.
Nash's main campaign issue? Fiscal responsibility as Gwinnett continues to grow and diversify. As for what that growth and diversity could mean for her re-election chances?
I think that's in the hands of the voters, and the voters have the power to make the decisions this time about who's elected.
There are, of course, moments where we can expect people who don't look like a particular group can actually make good decisions on behalf of everyone.
Michael Owen studies race and politics at Emory University.
A question, though, is does that always happen? No, it does not.
Owen says he's not surprised by the lawsuit over Gwinnett's voting districts. He says there are only so many ways for people to change the electoral process.
You can take to the streets. You could attempt to try to influence the state legislature, who ultimately decides whether maps are good or not. Or you rely upon the courts.
Then, of course, there are elections. It's unclear how the redistricting lawsuit will impact Jim Shealy's run for county commissioner. And a win won't mean the lawsuit just goes away. But it will mean someone has finally broken the color barrier in Gwinnett County government. Shealy says the key will be turnout.
It's not going to be easy to get to make sure that people get to the polls, get them out there to vote.
But the numbers could be in his favor, if just barely. 50.8% of registered Gwinnett voters are non-white. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Whitehead in Atlanta.
And it's Halloween, so you may be turning to the internet for makeup tips. It is a whole new world. There are thousands of videos, dozens of bloggers, many of them men. They call themselves beauty boys, the most prominent. 17-year-old James Charles, just chosen by CoverGirl to be the new cover boy. Here he is on his YouTube channel.
Hi guys, it's James Charles. Welcome back to my channel. So today I'm going to show you guys how I created this makeup look. I went with a red cup crease on the top and a very dark and greeny blue chunky glitter look on the bottom. I absolutely love this look. It's perfect for any event or festival season.
And it is. Let's bring in a friend of James, blogger Thomas Halbert of Asheville, North Carolina. Thomas is all of 19. He's had 200,000 followers on Instagram. He's traveling the country now for beauty companies. Thomas, welcome.
Hi.
This must have been thrilling for all of you bloggers who have labored on the internet when this happened with CoverGirl.
Yeah, it's crazy to me. And I'm so proud of James because I've been with him since he started Instagram. And I've been rooting for him since then. Just the fact that he's been able to do this is crazy.
Well, it's showing that companies are becoming more inclusive, you've told us. But it's also showing that they're smart. They see what's going on here.
Oh, yeah.
You guys have millions of followers combined. And you've already been contacted, I understand, by makeup companies.
Yes. Actually, the first makeup company that ever contacted me when I was at 6,000 followers was Too Faced. And at such a small number, that was crazy to me. And just the opportunities that I'm getting now at, you know, the numbers that I have now is insane. Just being able to travel to New York or L.A. and it's so great.
Because you've told us your family's not wealthy. Makeup is expensive. You weren't able to afford a lot of it.
So expensive.
You started as a freelance makeup artist, you know, maybe every now and then a bride. But now you can focus just on social media because there's, you know, revenue there. People traveling you around.
Yeah.
And what else? Ads on the site?
Instagram and Twitter and YouTube, they're all ad revenue based where a company could be, hey, we want you to talk about this product, and the company will pay that blogger, or the company will just give that blogger the makeup for free and the blogger will talk about it. That's pretty much how the industry works, which is saving these brands tons of money.
Yeah, this is great for business, but also for the cultural story that's behind this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And tell us more about that. I mean, it hasn't been accepted in the past.
Well, the makeup industry for a long time was geared towards a certain race and a certain gender. And now that there is social media and there is that demand and there is that conversation that's happening on social media, these brands are realizing that, hey, we have to cater to everyone as a way to show the world that it's okay to be this and you're allowed to embrace it. And just having a boy as a spokesperson for your company, that alone just, it just sends a huge message to like young girls and boys that are watching this commercial with a boy on it wearing makeup saying that it's okay and it's normal. And what I would love to see is I would love to see brands like CoverGirl or like L'Oreal or like the big name brands that have commercials on TV who have that power, that force in the mainstream world using trans models and trans men, trans women, or black models. But this is a step forward.
Well, you said when you were, I mean, you're only 19, but when you were much younger, a kid, and realizing you were gay and liked makeup, you wish you had something like this.
Exactly. I try to hide it. I try to suppress it. I tried to tell everyone, no, I'm straight. No, I don't love this thing because that's too girly or that's too gay. Growing up, I was playing with Barbies. My grandma, she bought me Barbies because she knew. My grandma knew. But here where I'm from in the South, it's, you know, shunned upon if you're a boy and you like things that go outside of your masculinity. Mm. It's just, it's great that now these younger gay boys have role models and get to even communicate with them through social media. It's just, it's so amazing.
Well, and now you, Thomas Albert, are on a list, for instance, of the 7 best male beauty bloggers you should follow right now in Allure. And they say, in fact, that you can put anyone's highlighter skills to shame. So let's hear a little of your tips for people going out on Halloween.
So there's this trend happening now on social media, in the beauty community on social media, where they're doing this melting skull effect. Just anything melting is trending right now. And they use this product from Ben Nye, and it's super inexpensive. It makes it look like your skin is like melting.
I'm looking, in fact, online. This is the Ben Nye Scar Gel. It makes it look like your skin is in blobs dripping down over your jaw, which can be painted black.
So yeah, if you have like a black backdrop, black makes it look empty. Black kind of suppresses things. It makes it look empty and not existent. And white kind of brings forward things that makes it look like there's something there. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It looks like your skin is then melting down over these empty black spaces around your jaw. That's 19-year-old makeup artist and beauty influencer Thomas Halbert of Asheville, North Carolina. We'll find a melting skull tutorial and post it at hereandnow.org along with Thomas's pictures. Thomas, thank you and happy Halloween.
No, thank you so much. I had a blast.
And Jeremy, I've been looking at some of the most popular costumes this Halloween. There's Olympic gymnasts, Bill Clinton and balloons from the conventions when he played with the balloons, and lots of little girls in pantsuits and boys in orange wigs for the candidates. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.